Let's kind of pick up where we left off, because we're going to skip a section. When we started back in chapter 5, we looked at the first 7 verses, and the theme of those was to walk in love, what it means to walk in love, to walk the way Jesus walked, to walk redemptively and sacrificially towards one another. Then we looked at another passage that was about walking in light, and we talked about what the light is compared to the darkness, and some some illustrations about what that means and how we apply that principle to our life. And then we did the same thing a couple of weeks ago, and we talked about walking in wisdom and what it means to be wise and redeeming the time and to live intentionally and to think things through and to make decisions instead of just kind of going wherever the wind blows us in our lives, to actually give ourselves over to the Lord and follow hard after Him. And then when we come to the next section, we're going to skip it because it's a passage that I taught last July. During that first month I was here, I picked out some what I thought were important messages, and so it's a little too soon to repeat, you know. And if you want to get the, you know what's funny? This one didn't tape. When we did it in July, this was the one that didn't tape. So maybe we'll do it again someday, but it was all about marriage. Remember that? And in a nutshell, it talked about the command, the instruction here was that husbands are to love our wives the way that Jesus loves the church. And that means that we put her first and that we sacrifice for her sake, to keep her safe, to keep her well and healthy and whole and happy and all the rest. And on the other hand, the wife's responsibility was to trust her husband, and because she trusted him, to cooperate with him. In a nutshell, that was the lesson. Wives were to trust. Husbands were to be trustworthy. And when we get into trouble is when one of the two players on the team drops the ball. Either the husband doesn't behave in a trustworthy manner, or the wife refuses to trust. Now, that's a pretty quick condensation of what was a 40-minute, 20-some-odd verse Bible study last July. But that's it in a nutshell. And now we pick up in chapter 6, verse 1, and I gave all that review because this is a continuation of thought. It really is a continuation of walking in wisdom. And I also want to point out that all of those things that we learned about marriage, there's only 10 or 12 verses there, all those things about husbands and wives and love and submission and trust and caring and all of that stuff, you'll see at about verse 32 of chapter 5, he says, "This is all a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church." In other words, all of that talk about marriage was just an illustration to teach us about the church. He wasn't using the church to teach us about marriage, which is how we usually approach that passage. He's drawing an illustration of from how he assumes a happy, healthy Christian marriage operates and saying, see, this is how it is in the church. This is how our relationship between the church, the bride, and Christ, our bridegroom, is. And so he talks about, in verse 21 of chapter 5, submit to one another. Then it was wives submit to husbands. Then it was husbands love your wives. And now in chapter 6, we move down the family hierarchy to children. And he says, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which he's quoting the commandment there, which is the first commandment with a promise. And the promise is that it may be well with you and you may live long on the earth. And you fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord. What we're talking about here, starting back in chapter 5 and continuing here in chapter 6, in a word, is responsibility. But you'll notice that it's a horizontal responsibility, a collateral responsibility. We assume that we have tremendous responsibilities to the Lord. Like that thing I read, if I were a good Christian, boy, here's what I'd do. My knees would be raw from my time in prayer. And they would have fired me from my job because I would have been out helping people who need help so much. That's what a good Christian does. But what we come to learn is that our responsibility as Christians as far as it works vertically, it's a responsibility to surrender to the Lord. But horizontally, that's where our responsibility to do and to act, and if I can use the word work, you know, to take action, to get stuff done, that's where our responsibility plays out horizontally. Now, the first thing he points out here is that children have a responsibility to their parents. Anyone who's ever been a child, raise your hand. Okay, I'm talking to you. And those of you that were hatched full grown, well, I've got a TV producer that wants your number. Children have a responsibility to their parents, and the first responsibility that he points out here is to obey. Children, obey your parents. When do you stop being a child? Never. Never. Maybe when your mom and dad go to be with the Lord and there's no one to be a child to. But until that happens, these responsibilities are in effect. Children, obey your parents. Now, this word obey, it's a two-part word. Obey. No, there's more to it than that. It's a two-part word, and it means listen, first of all. Listen to your parents and respond. Now, my kids usually had the first part down pretty good. They'd listen okay. You know, if you fired a shotgun and got their attention, and they'd say, what? And then you could tell them something, and they'd listen. But then before the responding part could kick into gear, it seems like they went back into kiddie world, and their eyes glazed over, and they went back into whatever it was that occupied their thoughts and actions at the time. And that's how my dogs are today. They're in dog land, and once in a while they snap out of it, but most of the time they just, you know, they don't care. That's how our kids are. Now, they aren't like dogs. Don't go away with that. That's not the lesson. But to obey means to listen, but then to respond to what you've been told. And why do we do that? Well, there's a lot of reasons that are not expressed in the text. One really good reason that I like to use with my kids, because I say so. No, that's not it. But you've used that, haven't you? It's because, well, you know, when I was 16, I knew all there was to know. And my dad didn't know anything. I don't know how he lived to be so old. Funny, the older I got, I realized the less I knew and the more he actually knew. See, the strange thing is as we go through life, we tend to learn things through trial and error, by making mistakes, by getting it right and experiencing the rewards. You learn as you grow older. And how... What a blessing, what an ingenious plan for God to gift each one of us with one or two older people who love us no matter how bad we mess up and are there to share this hard-earned life lesson, wisdom and knowledge with us freely. I mean, you couldn't hire somebody. I want you to be at least 20, maybe 30 plus years older than me, and I want you to know way more than me. And I want you to watch every step I take in my life. And I want you, because you love me, to, when you see me making a bad decision, I want you to intercede. I want you to interrupt me and tell me the right thing to do. See, now if you hired somebody to do that, you'd probably listen to them. You try to get your money's worth. But God's given us people like that, but we don't listen. And if we listen, we don't respond. I don't get how that works. There's a promise that comes with this. Obey your parents, first of all, because they know what they're talking about. Obey your parents in the Lord. That's the key to the thing. It honors God when you honor your parents. The same way that when a wife trusts her husband, and when a husband lives, conducts himself in a trustworthy manner, that honors God, because that's an accurate portrayal of the relationship between the church and Christ. And it's the same for children and parents. Obey your parents in the Lord, for it's the right thing to do. And there's the commandment, honor your father and your mother. And he says, it's the first commandment with a promise. We'll talk about that promise in a minute. Honor. I have yet to see a book, The 10 Keys to Honor. The 10 Steps to Honor. And it's because honor is an attitude, not an action. Honor is like the ultimate combination of love and respect and teachability. An open mind and an open heart towards that person to receive what they have to give you. He says, honor your father and mother. Have that attitude of honor towards them. Obey them, honor them. And he points out that this is the first commandment with a promise. He quotes it right here in the text, that it may be well with you, that's part A, and you may live long on the earth, that's part B. It'll be better for you if you obey and honor your parents. And all the parents are going like this to their kids. See, I told you. It'll go well for you, and the promise is that you'll live long. Now, here's what you need to understand something. As we go through the Old Testament, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, long about in there where we have those long lists of rules and regulations for life, do you realize that the parents of a rebellious and disobedient child had the legal right to kill that child? And some of you are longing for the good old days, aren't you? No, you're not really. And I don't have any idea how often they sort of put that rule into practice. But, you know, you've seen some kids where you think, you know, if that were an option. And I'm not just talking about they left dirty dishes around the kitchen sink. I'm talking about some kids, like some adults, just go south in their thinking. And is what is absolutely not okay to do ever is exactly what they do. And then they feel okay about it. We read stuff in the news every day, see stuff on, you know, CNN or whatever, about some crazy kid that did something that it's not just naughty, and it's not just bad, and it doesn't just deserve a spanking. They do the unthinkable, rape and murder and torture and unthinkable things. And in the Old Testament, the people actually had the permission to, if your child, if your, you know, teenager looked like they were headed that direction, and maybe it is some kind of brain damage or, you know, genetic thing gone awry, I don't know, but when you saw them and they were just unmanageable, disobedient, unrepentant, and disrespectful and all the rest, you actually had the right to put that child to death for the good of the whole society before he hurt someone else, before he did serious damage. We're not just talking about he was an embarrassment. We're talking about he was a danger, he or she. So that was the framework upon which this thing, and you will live a long life. If you kids obey your parents, if you honor your parents, it'll go well with you, and you'll live a long life. Now the second part of the deal here is in verse 4. And you fathers, and I think that goes for mothers too, you parents, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord. In other words, the same way that children have a responsibility to their parents, parents have a responsibility to their children. Now, my New King James says, fathers, do not provoke. You might have an NIV or some other translation where it says, do not exasperate them. I actually think exasperate is a better word because it sounds like what it is. Just say, I'm so exasperated. It kind of expresses the feeling, doesn't it? Instead of saying, well, I'm very provoked at you. Doesn't really do it, does it? But exasperated, that kind of, you know, expresses the feeling to be provoked, to be frustrated. One translation says, do not rouse them to wrath. Fathers, parents, don't provoke, don't exasperate, don't be so hard and so critical of your kids, on your kids, that you actually bring wrath out of them. Man, I'll never forget being in the first grade. We moved into a new house in a new neighborhood for us, and I was out there riding my bike up and down the driveway, up and down the gravel road one day, killing time. And we were fairly new to the neighborhood, but there was this one kid that lived up over the hill, and he was in the sixth grade, and he was a bully at school. He was just a mean, he'd like, you know, give you wedgies or push you down in the mud puddle or, you know, stomp on your toe and just do stuff to be mean. He was a mean kid, and so we all avoided him. And I was fairly new, and I didn't even know his name, but I knew, You know, I learned real quick, when you see this kid coming on the playground, you go the other way because there's nothing but trouble. So I'm riding my bike up and down the gravel road there, and I see this kid, the kid, you know, the bully. And I'm not going to go anywhere near him, but the deal is he's out there with his dad. And they've got like a flatbed type of truck with the rails on the sides. And there's something to do with some car batteries. And one of the batteries, I don't know, if maybe they'd fallen off as they were driving or something like that. And the kid, sixth graders, or what are they, this big? What are you, nine, ten, something like that? They're still little kids, so it's just a matter of perspective. But so here's this little kid, and he's trying to pick up this car battery. Now, I can barely pick up a car battery now, you know. And his dad is just, you pick that up, and he's yelling at him, and he's chewing him out, and he's belittling him, and he's just, you know, threatening him with take his belt off. You pick that up right now or you're going to be sorry. And I just, man, I'd never seen, my dad didn't talk to me that way, and I've never seen anybody's dad talk to him that way. His dad was as mean as he was, and in my own little first or second grade ability to get a handle on stuff, I recognized in that moment, wow, he's just like his dad. His dad was doing exactly what this scripture tells parents not to do. He was provoking his child to wrath. I mean, you could see it as he picked up that battery. He'd kind of look at his dad and go, he's thinking, I hate you. You could see it. You could just sense it. I hate you. That's what they're talking about here. Now, I was blessed. I had a great dad. I wish I'd have got a chance to know him better because he died when I was about 20. But my dad would never do anything like that. He disciplined me and all the rest and made sure I towed the line and knew right from wrong and behaved, but he would never exasperate me. He would never just ride me so hard that he made me grit my teeth and growl like a dog. And that's what we're talking about here. Fathers, don't do that. Don't provoke your kids to wrath. Colossians 3:21 says something almost just like it, where it says, fathers, do not embitter your children, or they will become discouraged. You know, you ride a kid so hard, he'll finally just give up. She'll just finally say, I can't please Mom. I've never been able to please Mom. I never will be able to please Mom. Forget it. I'm going to stop trying. But the second part of the verse here. But bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord. In other words, teach your kids the Lord's ways. Training and nurture. Those are words that come from horticulture. It means to cultivate, prepare the soil. In other words, make your child's life a hotbed for the things of God. You know, don't exasperate them. Instead, but the contrast is, make their life a virtual hotbed for the things of the Lord. Now, sometimes you got to plow before you can plant. But be careful. Yeah, you got to correct your kids. Yeah, we got to discipline our kids. You know, I think we talk about this in a minute. That verse about spare the rod, spoil the child. That's not what it says. It says spare the rod, hate the child. If you don't discipline your kids, keep them in line, teach them those lessons, how to behave when they're young. It's as if you hate them. But what he's talking about here before we get to there is train them, you know, nurture them, cultivate their lives in the things of the Lord. It's funny how you don't have to teach a child to disobey. You ever notice that? We're all born with that rebellious nature. We had some friends, Donna and Daryl, years ago, and they were, you know, our kids were in high school, but they had their first little baby, and so it was fun for us to watch these folks have their first kid. And little Brianna was born, and you know, pretty soon she's got teeth, and pretty soon she's starting to walk. And then after a while, she's starting to talk. A couple of years go by, and we're over at their house one time and having coffee, and we're talking about the church and how good the Lord is. And I remember Brianna's over there somewhere playing with toys, and Daryl says, Brianna, honey, come here and say hello to Pastor Ron and Mary. And Brianna turns around and goes, no! Just in this ugly, you know, vicious as a 2-year-old can get, that's in us. That's part of us. That rebellious part, you don't have to teach that, okay? Don't waste your time teaching that. Instead, bring them up in the things of the Lord. Now, discipline sometimes involves punishment. There's no question about it. And I already told you, Proverbs 13:24. He who spares the rod, he who spares the rod hates his son. But he who loves him is careful to discipline him. Now, I don't want one kid coming back to me next week with, you know, bruises and stripes, saying, well, you know, Pastor Ron said, no, that's not at all it. You listen to both sides of the story. Proverbs 22:15. Folly is bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod of discipline will drive him far from it. Proverbs 23. Do not withhold discipline from a child. If you punish him with the rod, he will not die. My dad knew that one. So how do I know? That's the question. How do I know when discipline is appropriate? And here's the difference. Punishment is for willful rebellion. It's not for when they make mistakes. You get the difference? Punishment is for when they willfully, knowingly, just you say go and they don't go, or you say stay and they go, and they knowingly contradict what you say. That's disobedience. But it's not the same as when they just make a mistake. I'll tell you two good illustrations of that. When I was in the sixth grade, I smile when I tell this because it wasn't me. There was this kid in the class named Dean. In fact, I still bump into Dean now and then these days. He's still around. Well, I don't know what the deal was with Dean. He wasn't a bully, but he was a tough guy. He was kind of, if you were ever in trouble and you could get Dean on your side of the fight, there was no fight. Because nobody messed with Dean. He was, you know, just about this tall and just thick as a brick and strong. And he was just built that way from day one. And he was a tough little kid. But the first day of school of sixth grade. Now, you know how exciting first day of school is. Because, you know, in those days, we'd have to get to the school to read the paper to see even which room we were in and who our teacher was. So you get there, and, oh, look, I'm in Mr. Cox's room. Oh, great. He's got that cool room up in the new part of the school. We're sixth graders. We're rocking. And so I'm up there, and, you know, we're having the first day of school, and Dean is somehow over here on one side of the room. And Mr. Cox says, Dean, would you hand me that? You know, something was on the back table, a yardstick or a book. Dean, would you hand me that? And I don't know what he was thinking. But Dean looked up and he said, why should I? And so Mr. Cox made this move and grabbed Dean by the arm and said, I'm going to show you why, young man. And took him in the back of the closet where nobody could see what was going on, but you could hear what was going on. And that's why I'm glad it wasn't me. Now, he didn't beat him to a pulp. He didn't abuse him, I think. And he took another teacher in there for a witness and all the rest. And they gave him a couple of smacks. And Dean didn't even cry, so it couldn't have been that bad. But he deserved it. That's my point. That was proper discipline. He, on the first day of school, he demonstrated utter contempt for the teacher. And the teacher couldn't let that be the standard that was set for all the other kids for the remainder of the year. And so he said, I'm going to use you, Dean, to demonstrate to all the children why. And all he did was say, hand me that book. It wasn't some weird deal. So that's proper discipline. Now, what's not proper discipline? And this was me. This is me. The last time I ever got whipped, I was, I don't know, 10 or 11, which I think is too old anyway. I'm raking leaves out in the yard. Mom says, go out and rake the leaves. So, yes, mother, you know, with my halo. And I'm raking the leaves, and she says, rake the leaves off the side of the lawn and just rake them under the car, and then we'll move the car and we'll scoop up all the leaves and take them out back in the burn pile. So I'm raking the leaves, and my dad comes out. Don't rake those leaves under the car like that. Yeah, but Mom said, just don't do it. Rake them over here in a pile. Okay, so, you know, with my halo still on. Yes, Father, and I'm raking the leaves now over into a pile, and then my mom comes out. I thought I told you to rake those leaves under the car. Well, yeah, Mom, but Dad said, well, I don't care what Dad said. I'm telling you, rake those leaves under the car. Yes, Mother, you know, and so I'm raking them back under the car. And then my dad came out again a little while later, and I'm just about done with the job, and I've got all the leaves off the yard, but they're under the car. And he walks out, and he's, didn't I tell you to rake those leaves in, not under the car, but in a pile? And I'm telling you, right there in the front yard, he whipped off his belt, and he grabbed me, and he gave me a couple of licks. And I'm thinking, this isn't fair. I don't deserve this, and I didn't deserve that, and I waited all my life to be able to say this in front of people. But you get the difference there? I wasn't willfully disobedient and rebellious and kind of insisting on doing things my way. I got caught in the middle of who knows what's going on in headquarters at our house. I don't know, but there was a disagreement and a difference, and they probably, I'm sure, didn't know that each one was giving me different orders, you know, but I didn't deserve that. I don't know what got into Dad that day, and maybe that's why it was the last time I ever got it. But you see the difference? Dean had it coming. He needed that correction, that discipline. I didn't. That's the difference. Parents have a responsibility not to be harsh with our kids, because that makes them harsh. But at the same time, you can't just let them run wild. You have to teach them discipline. You have to teach them the things of the Lord. The instruction in the admonition he's talking about, which is just to say teaching. It should be a lot like school, only it's the school of life. In the school of life, what are you teaching your kids? Dads, are you teaching your kids that the thing to do is to come home and flip on the ball game and light a pack of cigarettes and open a six-pack of beer, and that's how life is to be lived? Or are you teaching them that when you get up in the morning, it's really a pretty good idea, the first thing, to sit down there and go over a verse or two or a chapter or something of God's Word and let that set the pace for your day? Moms, what are you teaching? Because whether you mean to or not, you're teaching them. Your kids are going to be just like you. Your sons are going to treat their wives the way you dads treat your sons. Your little girls, Mom, are going to treat their husbands exactly the way you treat your little girl's dad. The way you interact with each other, you are teaching them all day, every day, for better or worse. That's what he's talking about when it says, don't exasperate them, but bring them up. Interesting, Deuteronomy 6 says, these commandments I give you today are to be upon your hearts. In other words, not a rule book, not the 10 thou shalt nots, not the do's and don'ts, but are to be on your heart. Impress them on your children. That means you teach them and you example them. Talk about them when you sit down at home, when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up, which is another way of saying all day, every day, whether it's with words or with whatever you do, teach your kids about the Lord. That's your responsibility. You want to serve the Lord? You don't have to go to India and sleep in the mud and smuggle Bibles and do something weird and something hard like that. How about just raising your kids? That's what God asks us to do. That's your responsibility. Now we move on. We talked about children. We talked about parents. Now we come to a section that talks about slaves and masters. But notice that at least in my New King James, it uses the word bond servants. And this is important before we get into the text. When you ask an American born or raised in the last century or so what slavery is all about, the first and often the only picture that comes to mind is what we saw on Roots. White Europeans taking big boats to Africa, rounding up dark-skinned people like they were a herd of animals, cramming them into the bottom of the boat in an unhealthy, unsafe, inhumane manner, shipping them across the ocean, taking the survivors, which usually the rate was maybe 50% would survive the trip, and putting them up on the block just like cattle at an auction, not worrying about husbands, wives, children, no family relationships, and selling them like property. That's the only picture we have of slavery. And that is, it is what it is. That's our history. And it's really hard to water down slavery of any kind. But you need to understand that the slavery that took place here in the first century in the Middle East was way different. It was still slavery. It was still awful. But it was way different from that picture we have of the early American history and roots. Middle Eastern first century slaves, they were considered property, yes, but they were considered human as well. It wasn't like our history where we considered those Africans to be another type of animal that just happened to look like people. Now, in the first century, you knew that they were people, and you appreciated that. A lot of times in the first century, we go to the bank and get a loan when we need money. We need to buy something serious. And a lot of times in the first century, a father or the husband of the house would indenture himself as a slave for a period of time, a year, 2 years, 5 years, in order to get some money to do something, to take care of something, to buy property or pay a debt or whatever the case might be. And it was a whole lot like an employer-employee relationship. You still gave up a lot more of your rights than we do just for the companies that we work for. But it was a lot like that employer-employee relationship. You know, the slaves had families. They had, you know, husbands and wives, moms and dads and kids, and they weren't very often split up and sold off. They were recognized as families. And they were, a lot of times, the slaves in the household became like family with the people that owned them. They were a lot like, you know, upstairs, downstairs, where they're live-in servants. And they live in your house, and they have their quarters, and they eat, and they sleep, and they have their lives there, and their job is to work for you in the household, but you don't treat them like animals, you don't treat them like dirt, you treat them like humans, and you treat them well, and that was what a lot of these first century slave situations were like. And so, when, in verse 5 of Ephesians chapter 6, Paul says, bond servants, or slaves, be obedient to those who are your masters according to the flesh, with fear and trembling, in sincerity in Christ, he's really describing a relationship that is a lot closer to an employer-employee relationship than it is that early American concept of slavery. Okay? What we're going to see here is in the same way that children have a responsibility to parents and parents have a responsibility to children, so do workers have a responsibility to their employers. Bond servants or workers, employees, be obedient or obey. It's the same word we saw up in verse 1. It still means listen and respond. It means you as a worker, as an employee, have an obligation, have a responsibility to listen to what your employer tells you to do and to respond to it. There's nothing more frustrating than having had employees before than to give them explicit instructions. Here's what I want you to do. Here's how I want you to do it. And sometimes even here's why I want you to do it. And then you come back later and they haven't done it. It just makes you want to pull your teeth out because the job didn't get done and you were responsible and you counted on this guy or this gal and they just sort of didn't do it for whatever reason. See, that's not supposed to be an option to just not do it. Obey, he says. Listen and respond to your employers according to the flesh. That is, they're your master according to the flesh, as opposed to the Lord, your master in the spirit, with fear and trembling, with sincerity of heart. And here's really the bottom line, as to Christ. Wherever you work, if your boss was Jesus Christ, would you do things a little differently? Yeah, maybe. Well, see, what he's telling us here is that he is. Your boss is Jesus Christ. And even if your boss is a rat, even if your boss doesn't know what he or she is doing, even if you know more about what needs to happen than the person you work for does, which is often the case, been there, done that, still we're to respect and honor and listen to that person as if they were Christ. Not with eye service, he says. In other words, not just when they're looking, you know, not just putting on a show as men pleasers, but as bond servants of Christ. And that's what we are. Bond servants. We've given ourselves over to slavery. Nobody came and got us against our will. Nobody rounded us up, threw a rope on us, threw us in a boat, and we resent and resist the whole process. No, we volunteered for this job. We said, Lord, here I am, send me. I'll be your servant. I am your servant, Lord Jesus Christ, and I will be your servant all the rest of my life. That's us doing the will of God from the heart, just as you would work for the Lord. That is, with respect, fear, sincerity of heart, not only when they're watching, not only as eye service, but like slaves of Christ. That is, willingly, gladly, with a desire to please. And now the shoe's on the other foot. Workers have a responsibility to their employers, but employers, I don't know if we have any bosses here, but you have a responsibility to your workers, to the people that work for you. Verse 9, and you masters, do the same things to them, giving up threatening, knowing that your own master also is in heaven, and there is no partiality with him. See, we all work for the big boss in the sky. And if you have authority over someone, it's your responsibility to treat them with the same honor and respect and care and concern as the Lord would have for you. Treat them the same way as though Jesus were working for you. Let's turn it around, boss. You come into the office, out there on the factory floor, or there in the shop, or we're in the office, or wherever, out at their desks are all the little Jesuses answering their phones, taking messages, doing work, filling out forms, faxing, copying on their computers. That's how we're to consider them, and that's how we're to treat them. You know, there is no better boss to work for than the Lord. Because you can know that even when he gives you an assignment and you don't think you can pull it off, if he didn't think you could pull it off, he wouldn't have given you that assignment. He wouldn't have asked you to do it if he wasn't going to be there to do it in you and through you. This responsibility, or these responsibilities that we have, whether it's husbands and wives or moms and dads and kids and employers, employees, and whichever angle connection you want to look at, all of our relationships that we have with one another are intended to be the outworking of our relationship with the Lord. Isn't it interesting that the cross is a vertical line and a horizontal line? Could have been a circle, could have been a fish, could have been a dove. Some want it to be a fish and a dove, and dove and fish are okay, but it was a cross because it's where the vertical, the man and God connection works itself out horizontally. What God wants from us is not sweat and toil and labor and striving. It's just surrender. Father, here I am. Send me. Fill me. Use me. But horizontally with each other. That's where the work comes in. That's where the biting the tongue, the swallowing the harsh words. It's where it all comes together and where it works out. That's where our faith works itself out, the way we deal with one another. Strangers, employees, employers, children, parents, that's where our love for the Lord works itself out.